You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Radio Rehab, where every Saturday we try to talk about sobriety, recovery, how people get clean and sober, where they get clean and sober, how they change the quality of their life, how they reconnect to their families and their jobs, their schools. And we always have an exciting hour here where we talk about life and how to do it without a drink or a drug one day at a time. And my guest today is a perfect Father's Day weekend kind of person to share. We all fathered him when he came into sobriety. He has been drinking and using drugs before puberty, and he's going to share his story with you. Seriously, at 8 years old, he was already getting a buzz by alcohol, and at 10, by marijuana. So he's got an incredible story and journey, and coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and letting a lot of us father and mother him into his sobriety, where now he fathers and mentors and big brothers other boys that are trying to get in and get clean and sober. Jane's visiting with us too. If anybody else wants to come and visit, you're welcome to come and sit in and spend this hour with us talking about recovery at the Curtis Building at WEOA Radio.
Or they got us in a great place in the basement.
I know. Isn't that perfect? Perfect. That's where they used to have meetings always, in basements.
In the basements,
places.
That's right.
Yeah. So also, as you can see, this is going to be a lively discussion. If you want to call and ask Trey any questions or any comments, if you know him, want to say anything, want to dog him, please feel free to call.
Oh, don't do the dog thing. That'll light the phones up immediately.
424-1400, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Trey, who has 17 and a half years clean and sober as a result of working a good program and mentoring and being mentored by a lot of good old-timers in AA. Trey, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me again, Lisa. It's always fun to be around you, and it's always a hoot when Jane shows up. When Jane shows up, the party's on.
I mean, the room lights up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
The blonde bombshell walks in.
Yeah, the music starts. Yeah, you know, yeah. It's all good.
And then you too, and you could jumpstart any room.
Well, I try. Definitely. I mean, it's like one of my latest tattoos. That's one of my new addictions. It says, you know, life's too short not to dance,
yeah.
You know? And I mean, not that I dance a lot. Well, okay, I do. But
emotionally.
It's a metaphor, you know?
Yeah.
Do what you enjoy in life, and you know, if you're not hurting anybody, what difference does it make?
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, but you couldn't hear the music. I have a friend in Florida who sends that to me, that quote, every once in a while on Facebook.
So are you a big Facebooker?
Oh, I'm a Facebook creeper. That's what my, yeah.
What's a Facebook creeper?
I can tell you what everybody's doing in the world of Facebook. I got up and checked it. You know, I checked it at 4 o'clock this morning before I went to sleep. I checked it when I got up again at 8, you know.
Nope. Is that another addiction?
It can be.
Internet?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm hearing a lot more about internet addiction these days, but I didn't know about Facebook.
And I talk to, like, friends of mine, you know, that I've known most of my life that are in recovery out on the West Coast, you know, guys that I raced with over the years who ended up in recovery. It's amazing how I always find people who are just like me, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And it's helped me connect with some people. I have a friend of mine moved away in the fifth grade. Just up and disappeared.
That you remembered?
And he found me on Facebook. No, that was a false alarm.
Is that a false
alarm?
Wait, they're already calling. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, good morning. I'd just like to say that I've known Trey for quite a few years. I was in the military with his father, and his positiveness is... words of uplifting are always encouraging to those who are trying, and it's people like him that are making the program work, and I'm just damn proud to say that he's my friend and consider him like a brother.
Well, thank you so much for calling. You knew his father, huh?
Yeah, we were in the military together. He was my commanding officer.
Yeah.
And like I said, just a time where we weren't absolutely positive that we knew each other until certain events happened in Trey's life, certain events happened when his father passed away, and then we reconnected again, and then
I was having a hard time. I couldn't hear the speaker. Brother. Now I know who it is.
You know who's calling in?
Yeah, I think it's Big John.
He knows who it is.
All right. I couldn't hardly hear you, big man. Let me hold a dollar.
Is that Big John?
Get with me at 12.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Yeah, John was a...
All right, bro.
Not the Big John you're thinking of. It's another friend of mine. We ride Harleys together and hang out, I knew him when I was a kid when he served under my dad, and later on when we got older, we started hanging out again and didn't realize who each other was until right after my father passed away.
No,
you know,
kidding.
So I was, yeah, and he and I hang out even today, you know.
Did you know he was in recovery?
No, he's not.
Oh.
No, John's not. Not.
But he notices the recovery in you.
Yeah, he knows about all that. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if he ever saw me drink or anything like that. I don't recall. But like I said, you know, for the past 17 years, that's pretty much how much we've been hanging out, really.
That's great.
But he's one of them weird people who can drink a couple beers and go home. I don't get that, man.
I know, a social drinker.
Yeah. What's wrong with you, man?
So at 8 and 10, you'd already started
eight years
on a
old,
chemical.
Man, I was just like, I was wound, you know? I guess I was pre-ADD, but I don't...
Pre-ADD.
I just, yeah. And I can remember the first time, you know, getting drunk. And I was 8 years old. I was with my stepdad, and we were drinking Tom Collins. And to this day, I don't know what's in a Tom Collins. I just know it made me feel what I didn't want to feel anymore. And I could laugh at the world, man. I mean, I was literally in my mind, I remember Mom yelling at both of us because I was just blitzed. I mean, I was laying on the ground laughing at her because I couldn't get up.
Mm-hmm.
And if I knew what the bird was, I'd have been flipping the bird to the world because that's how I felt.
With the first drink?
With the first time I crossed that line. Now, I was a beer chaser as a kid. You know, if anybody needed one out of the cooler, I'd go get it and take a swig on the way back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I liked it, because it doesn't taste that great.
It's the effect.
Yeah, yeah. But that's, yeah.
So that's how it started.
That's how it started. And some, you know, later on, some older kids I ran around with were smoking this stuff one day, and I liked the smell of it. And I was like, hey, what's that? And they told me it was marijuana and asked me if I wanted some. And of course I did. I didn't know what it was, what it did, but... You know, and then I figured by 12, I could roll a perfect joint. You know? I liked bowls a lot better because it was a whole lot quicker. You just stuff it in there, fire it, and go.
Mm-hmm.
But
so weed became your main thing.
If I could, in all honesty, and we talk about marijuana maintenance and we joke about it, if I could smoke weed and do nothing else, I would. But and I tried it. I was sober for a year at one point in my life. And after that year... And I will say I didn't work the steps. I just hung out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I see people that do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hang out in Alcoholics Anonymous and somewhat get a better life. But if you don't implement the steps, you're going to do the same thing. Well, I was out with some friends and somebody fired up a joint. And I was like, man, that smells good. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I smoked weed for about a month. And then after that, it was just right back off to the races. You know, I drank. The first night I drank after being sober for a year, I drank like I never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I was... at a payphone in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, calling somebody, and one of my notorious crying drunks.
Uh-huh.
You know? Crying and fighting, that's all I wanted to do.
When you were drinking?
Yeah. Yeah.
So immediately when you got into weed and alcohol, that became the center of your life, or did you try to keep it together for school or for family, or did you just get immersed in it?
In high school, I'd say I crossed to the point where it didn't really matter. You know, the holidays around my family were a little different depending on where you were at. A lot of times it was we made phone calls in advance to see who was bringing the ups, the downs, and the watering hole, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody knew that somebody was bringing something to the game. You know, we'd play cards and drink and get high. I mean, that's just...
The obsession was there.
Yeah, and I was in a lot of different family situations which were perfect for me, I guess. You know?
Yeah, nobody had, you weren't still too long.
Right.
But
right.
Did they know, your family, that you were drinking and...
Well, yeah, they all drank with me. Everybody drank. You know, a lot of them, especially the younger ones, we all partied together. Some of the older ones were in on it, you know.
So do you think in some families that's normal?
It was normal for my family.
For everybody to drink?
You know? Yeah.
And smoke weed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not to bust her anonymity, but you guys know my mom hangs out with us in the rooms, you know. I mean, I think it's genetic. I can't prove it because I'm not a doctor. I just play one on TV.
Well, there is proof that biology plays a significant role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe that the setting that you're brought up in, no matter what, my son always said, well, I'm never going to drink or do anything like that, you know, because I saw, you know, what it did to you and Granny and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he didn't drink like we did. He found pills. Bless his little heart.
I know, and they think that's different in their heart because they're not drinking and smoking weed.
I'm pretty proud of him now, though. He's working 6 days a week and doing his deal, and people are buzzing my cell phone. Y'all can't text me while I'm on the air.
How old is he, Trey?
21.
Oh, my God. You're still a baby-looking thing to have a 21-year-old son.
Thank you.
My God.
Yeah, he just got engaged.
Wow.
I told her she's crazy, but, you know, anybody that tries to get into my family, I tell them they're nuts in the first place, right?
So did everyone in your family get clean and sober like you and your mom, or are a lot of them still out there in the addictions?
Not all of them had it as bad as we did. You know, I know my grandfather drank, and my mom's recently told me there's been some drinking on the other side of her family. My dad was, I can't say, you know, it was just one of those deals. It was nothing for him to have a beer in his hand or a drink in his hand, but, you know, very few times do I remember him, you know, falling down wasted, unless that's what we set out to do. And Dad and I were drinking buddies for a long time. Mm. You know, that was kind of our connection.
Your father-son thing.
Harley's,
Father's Day.
Yeah, for Harley's and liquor and women, you know, it was all good.
No kidding. All your life?
For the most part of it. It was kind of sporadic, the times we got to spend together. As I got older, it got better because I could make my own decisions and go, you know, see him when I wanted to and do what I wanted to do.
So how do young boys that have that kind of relationship with their father and the other men in their family or in their community, how do they ever figure out there's something not right about all that?
If that's all you know, that's all you know.
Yeah, it's almost like that's normal.
You know, it was, you remember the show Leave It to Beaver?
Sure.
My family was not like that. You know, I was more like the Addams Family, I guess. You know, we're creepy and we're kooky, you know?
I don't know that there's too many beaver families.
No, that stuff just doesn't exist anymore.
No.
But, I know some people that aren't like that.
You were Ozzy Osbourne's.
Yeah, I was more like Jack.
And Addams Family.
Yeah.
So did you at any point in your addiction realize that it wasn't right? And what?
Oh, there was multiple times I had that somewhat of a moment of clarity or moment of truth where something ain't right, you know. But I just kept doing it because that's all I knew, you know. And I didn't like feeling the way I felt about things. I don't know.
So that just fed the addiction.
Yeah. I'm a big emotional person. Mm-hmm. I got it from my grandfather. But
was he emotional?
Oh, yeah. He could. If something was real special to him, he'd tear up. And when I got older, I tear up. I'm like, I'm having a grandpa moment, you know.
Yeah. I think that's pretty common with people like us, that we are hypersensitive, you know, and at least in my active drinking days, you know, I would drink not to have to go to those extreme feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get hurt real easily. Don't you find
that? Oh, yeah, true? Yeah. If I'm numb, then you can't hurt
me.
Right,
right.
You know?
You think that's the main attraction to the drinking and drugging?
Numbing out, that's it.
Yeah, I think so, too.
You know,
some people just need that numb out. Others can quit when they have a little buzz.
Yeah.
But people like us just go for the oblivion, as the big book says, the numb out.
Till I'm down for the count.
Right.
And we'll get up and do it again the next day.
So was your using always that way?
Excessive. Oh, yeah, for the most part.
You didn't progress into heavy use.
No,
you were using
I was
heavy
there. I was there pretty much immediately. I mean, I didn't do it on a daily basis for a long time until I got older. But
when you did it, look out.
Yeah. Yeah, it was on.
Yeah. So what happened, Trey, that finally got your attention?
Which time?
Well, the very first time.
The first time I went to treatment, I've only been to treatment once. I was 19. I was living in College Station, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten in some trouble. Go figure.
Legal?
Yeah. I got arrested one time. My best friend Steve came down. He was stationed in the Army up the road. And he came down and we were having a little drinking fiesta. And we were both underage, and I decided in one of these brilliant moments that I would take the pitcher we were drinking beer out of with us back to the house. They got me for theft under $30, so or under $50. And then to get out of legal trouble, I had to get another job, so I was working two jobs, and I started doing a lot of coke at that time. Then I got a DUI. And
this was all at 19.
19, yeah. And I got offered 6 months in the penitentiary or treatment. Now, they don't play around in Texas, man. They got the death penalty, and they'll use it. I ain't lying.
For a DUI
my
or for the coke?
My first offense. I never got caught with the coke.
So they were going to give you 6 months for your first DUI?
My first DUI, I was getting 6 months in Huntsville State Penitentiary. And I've seen it on TV, man. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't do that.
Glad you weren't.
I thought I was a tough guy, but hey, you can have all that.
Yeah.
So I hid out for a while because I didn't want to do treatment, but I ended up going to treatment. I came to one day in my buddy's driveway because I was living in his van.
Jeez.
He had gotten arrested the night before.
So you were homeless.
Yeah, I was basically homeless. And he had a mobile home and he lived by himself, but I only slept in the van. Mm. Hey, at least I had a place, right? I mean, beggars can't
be choosers. When you're addicted, that's all you care about.
Well, he had got arrested on our way home from the lake, and they let me drive the van home, which I was joking, say they let me drive my house home. And I came to in the driveway that morning, and I had that moment of clarity. You know, my thing is, I woke up, came to, whatever, and I said, man, something ain't right. You know, I just vividly in my mind said something ain't right. And I made a couple phone calls to my family members down there, and they were like, yeah, that treatment deal you might want to do. And so they took me to treatment.
Was it an inpatient?
Yeah. It was inpatient. And
so did you get into it once you were there, even though you went kicking and screaming?
Kind of, but not really. I you know, you always get the suggestions, you know, get a sponsor, go to meetings, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'd say blah, blah, blah. If I had to listen to it now, where would I be today? I don't know. You know.
So do you think at 19 it's just a tough sell?
I think it's and everybody's got a different bottom.
Yeah.
I knew I was at my bottom then. I mean, where could I go but under a bridge or the park bench from the van?
In a car, yeah.
You know, I was already in a van that didn't belong to me. I mean, it wasn't even in my name.
So treatment, though, still, you couldn't?
I stayed sober for a little while. I got kicked out of treatment. They put me in a little housing unit out back, and a bunch of graduates went out one night down there in Killeen, Texas, and I went with them. And you know what? They just got out of treatment, and they were drinking and smoking weed. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I didn't drink or smoke, but I was late the next morning, and we had words, and I left.
Well, I guess it's pretty hard when you're in treatment and then realize people that just got out of treatment are back to using. It makes you think this doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, especially if they were graduating in front of me. You know, you guys are supposed to be smart about this.
Right. So you didn't have a good first experience of role models of sobriety, it sounds.
Well, if I'd have paid attention to the right people, I would have been better off, you know.
True, yeah.
Yeah, stick with the winners.
Yeah.
Like Jane said.
Yep.
You need to get close to your microphone, girl. I can't hear you.
I can't listen to you. When you were in treatment at that age, did they introduce you to 12 to AA meetings?
Oh, yeah. We went to meetings and stuff, and they, you know, I'd listen to people give their leads and whatnot. And I actually asked a guy to be my sponsor one time and got his phone number, but I never called him.
So when you were there, you could get into it, but the minute you left the room, you were back to being trapped.
I stayed out for a little while. I stayed in recovery for a little while. A family of people that were in recovery took me into their home, and we'd go to meetings for a little while. And one night I was out with one of the kids and their girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, and we just started drinking. I don't know. It just
weren't ready.
Nah. No, I wasn't ready.
And that was at 19?
Yeah.
So now looking back, if you could have done anything different at 19, because we're seeing a lot of 19-year-olds come in now, and 18-year-olds. Yeah. What do you think we need? What kind of way do we need to reach the younger people?
I don't know. I mean, in the past 17, 18 years, it's changed a lot. I mean, you know how it used to be when we used to sit at Columbia and Linwood at nights until, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning with guitars and coffee and people singing Kumbaya or whatever.
It was
a
party all the time.
With Oak Carry M, know, and people would bring drums and keyboards, and it was just, you know, or we'd all go bowling together.
A lot of fellowship.
The fellowship was awesome back then. Right now, it is so different.
There's just so many meetings now. too. It used to be we all knew each other.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you can catch a meeting, six meetings a day.
There's 160 a week in Evansville now.
Well, divide that by seven, that's, you know.
Several clubs. I mean, we used to only have Columbia and Linwood.
Well, in the Old Stone.
And St. Ben's was everybody's Saturday morning.
St. Ben's on Saturday morning. Christ the King or Wednesday night, the old Regina group.
Fritz, yeah.
Yeah, 300 people in that meeting. Right. On a good Wednesday, you'd have 300 people in there. That was awesome.
Now you don't see 300 people in a meeting unless it's an area dinner or Founders Day.
And you don't get them like that anymore either.
Right.
It's not nearly like it used to be. I mean, we used to have the area dinners, the you know, just eat meetings in general.
Right.
You know, you put food on the table, my fat behind's there.
A lot of people were going out to eat after a meeting.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, well, don't go away, Radio Rehab. We're talking to Trey and Jane, and we're going to talk about Father's Day and more about recovery. Hi, everybody. We are back talking to Trey, who loves sobriety and loves Alcoholics Anonymous and all the things it's brought to his life. So before break, we were talking about the first intervention was when he was 19.
Actually.
And went into treatment.
I got my first intervention. I got sent to a Southern Indiana Mental Health Center thing at 15 because I actually got popped for possession of marijuana at school.
Yeah, that's right. You had to go to the classes over there.
Yeah. And I got a slight introduction to AA when a member of my family was in treatment the first time back in the 80s. I don't even remember when it was.
So AA and recovery have kind of been on the burner there, but
my
your
first big book I found on the shelf at my old house, and it was actually my mom's. So, you know.
How old were you
already,
when your mom got in recovery?
Which time?
This last stretch.
This last time, it's been 11 years ago, 12 years ago?
Yeah.
Wow, 11 or 12 years ago. Yeah, that's a whole other story.
Trying. Yeah, that could be a whole other Saturday show when a mother and son come into recovery together. But you both contribute largely to the recovering community. So, okay, so you, at 19, went through your first, like, inpatient.
Yeah, and I didn't go back to rehab after that. I didn't do another treatment center.
You probably thought they didn't work.
I wasn't forced into it. That's kind of what happened.
You have to be forced, yeah.
I was kind of forced and found that place, you know. And I see a lot of young people today, and you know, there's not an age limit on this deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're out of control and you know you're out of control, I mean, we're here to help. You know, that's the whole deal. And that's the biggest thing I've found over the years is just people think that they're too young or whatever. You know, and I've seen people who thought they were too young not get to be very much older.
Uh-huh. Oh, I know. Absolutely. The graveyard's full of them.
Full of people who thought they had the answers. You know, and I've seen old people do it too, though.
Right.
You know?
Right. But I work with parents that are scared to death that phone call's going to come at 1 in the morning.
Yeah.
Scared to death. Were your parents scared to death with your lifestyle, too?
No.
Not really?
They didn't really notice, I don't guess.
Because of their drinking.
Yeah, I mean, my dad wasn't totally around all the time. You know, my parents divorced when I was real young, so. And I drank when I was around him. I mean, I didn't hide. I was the black sheep of the family, and I wore that title well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You were going to keep that title.
I was a king of the black sheep.
You were the king of the black sheep.
Yes. My fact of the family, my dad's side of the family is having a family reunion, and we've kind of had a falling out since he passed. And I got on Facebook, and they've got their own little reunion thing set up. And I was like, I wonder if the black sheep ought to show up.
I think the black sheep should, don't you, Jane?
Everybody kind of made it. It's a big joke with the family.
Are you
now,
still the
though.
Black sheep now that you're sober for 17?
No, but I just like to still act
remind
like I am.
Remind them,
yeah. Don't
I
forget.
Yeah. You always stay in that role in the family, kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. It's just.
So how did you finally get back into recovery, or what kind of things happened after that first experience?
After that, I left Texas, went to Arkansas, and lived with my dad for a few months, got arrested a few times there. Came home for a weekend of Thunder on the Ohio, which I'm sorely going to miss.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to discuss that. And anyways, came home for a weekend, and I've been here ever since.
Here in Evansville?
Yeah, I came back to Evansville for a weekend, and I stayed. Hooked up with a young lady, and we ended up having a son and getting married and getting divorced. And And my drinking was way out of control at 21, 22 years old. I mean, way out of control.
And that's when you got married and had a child.
I got married at 21. I got married at 20 or 21 and was divorced by 22. Mm. You know.
And had a baby.
Yeah. Yeah, if my son walked in the room right now, there'd be no denying whose kid he was.
Really?
Yes, yes. My girlfriend makes jokes about it all the time.
A clone of Trey.
I call him Mini-Me.
Even the drinking and drugging?
I don't know for a fact. I think if he's doing it, he hid it from me well. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean,
you would know.
I've been told by his friends that he wouldn't drink or smoke weed with them because he didn't want me to smell it. I think that's where the pills come in for a lot of kids. Mm-hmm. You know, the pill thing,
that's
because
true.
You can't smell it. You know?
And they're out of your system in 3 days if you get a drug screen where pot stays in there a couple
weeks.
Right,
right. So after that, another family member died. My stepdad died. He was a super cool dude. I got divorced. She left. My stepdad died, and I lost a job. And in a 24-hour period, I went crazy. I mean, just literally crazy. I lost my job. I was in the bar drinking by 10 o'clock in the morning. The following morning at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, I was getting pulled over. And I had been drinking that whole time. And this was back
for drunk driving.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, yeah. I got pulled over and they let me go because I'd pulled into a family member's car lot when they pulled me over, and I was like, "Look, I got keys to the building." And I did have. And I didn't realize that there were people in the building, and they had put a black blanket over the window so it looked like the lights were out. There were people in the building partying.
Whoa.
I got in another car in the car lot that had keys in it and pulled out and got arrested in another car.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's insanity, man.
Yeah.
It's insanity. So the thing about it was when they pulled me over and I knew I was going to jail. The weird thing about it was my dad used to be on City Police Department. So I rode in the back of a cop car as a kid. I think I got too comfortable there. I really do.
You just fell right for that police life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was like, hey, I've been here before. So they
the
pulled
back
me
of
over.
A police
and
car.
And the whole deal was just like, or, you know, he started with the questions, you know. Have you been drinking? Yeah. How much have you had to drink? I'm like, dude, I don't know. He's
who
like,
cares?
How long have you been drinking? I said, what time is it? You know?
Oh,
and he's like, oh, man, this ought to be fun. So his buddy comes with a little machine, and they're going to make me blow in the machine. And I'm like, it don't matter. I'm going to blow 0.15. Which 0.10 at that time was our legal limit. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was over a decade ago.
Yes. So I blew 0.15. And I had just left a dollar pitcher night at a local establishment that doesn't exist anymore. And when I drank out of the pitcher, it didn't matter if it was Long Island iced tea, beer, whatever it was, I didn't get a glass. I drank out of the pitcher. And back then, I weighed like 115 pounds.
Trey, so your tolerance was out the door.
Oh, it's crazy off the chain. So they took me downtown because they thought, you know, when they got me downtown, they were like, we're going to put you on the real machine. I'm like, you're going to get 0.15 out of me. I mean,
at least.
And that's all that, I mean, no, I mean, I'd been drinking for 12, 14 hours straight, nonstop.
So you were probably more than 1.5.
No, it's what I blew on a machine, 0.15.
Wow.
And I had drank quite a few pitchers in that last hour.
How long did it take, though, for them to get you down there and breathalyze you?
At the most. I mean, and I just left the bar.
So did they ticket you?
I went to jail. Ticket, yeah, I got a nice ticket. Cold cot. You know, if you drink and get in trouble with the law, let me tell you what you get to look forward to. A cold jail cell with a nice shiny toilet in the corner and everybody else can watch you do your business. Oh, there you go.
That's jail.
That's jail. Nasty food, green bologna.
So you were drunk.
There was no doubt about it.
So did you get
drunk
out the next day?
I got out the next morning. My stepbrother came and got me. And he's like, man, you think that's bad? He goes, somebody stole a car off the car lot. And I just went, oh, wow.
It was you.
It's an impound, dude. And he's like, really? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, at least I know where to find it. You know, because he was one of those drinkers with me. He was one of the guys that told me he was in the car lot drinking, and I didn't know they were there. I could have walked. If I had walked inside, really, like I told the cop I was going to, I may not be sitting here today.
You may not.
So I get this thing called the Dad's Program.
Right.
Drug and alcohol deferral service.
Yes.
And that back, this was back when they trusted you on your own merit. And there's reasons why. You didn't have to take sheets. I'm not a big sheet signer. Judge, if you're listening, I still hate signing sheets. Thank you for that PSA. So I had these two counselors, and Jim Christian was one of them. And I'm not breaking his anonymity
he shouted from the rooftops.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he taught me a lot about AA. He was never my sponsor, but he lived it, and that was it.
That's right.
And I couldn't figure out, you know, I was like, man, this old man was 17. It's odd. And he was 17 years sober at the time. Wore them old ugly UK suspenders, you know the ones.
Oh, sure.
Smoked them big, stanky cigars.
Yes.
I'm sober 17 years. I'm like, liar, you got a bottle under the seat of your car. Ain't nobody been sober 17 years. And I couldn't figure out, you know, why they would say, well, what meetings did you go to this week? And I could tell them. Well, it's because when you were sitting in a meeting, back then our meetings were less sporadic.
Right.
Jim was usually there. He knew if I was lying or not.
They didn't need sheets.
Yeah.
We knew if you all were it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I'd go to meetings and
So did you go with a different frame of mind?
No. I went and I would leave and I'm not very personable.
Yeah, right.
And I met some people and they were cool and found out one guy was actually, his mom was my favorite bartender, you know, back at the tavern, and that was kind of cool. And he ended up being my first sponsor, which was even cooler. But I would go to meetings and we would leave and go to the tavern and I can remember one night I was like, oh, man, let's stop and have a beer on the way home. And we closed the bar.
After the meeting.
Yeah. Or maybe even after the dad's program. Mm-hmm. So then a couple nights later, we did it again. And I was like, well, maybe we'll have two, you know, because I was trying to justify and play it out in my mind. We closed the bar again. And on February the 1st of 92, I came to and made a phone call and went to CNL at a noon meeting and got Desire Tip. And I stayed chemically free minus caffeine and nicotine for a year. And I had my first sponsor was the hippie, mm-hmm. and that's what I call him. The hippie, the guppy, and the fat boy were three very key people in my life. Mm-hmm. The hippie was my first sponsor, and he played music, and his mom was my favorite bartender. And he's like, you know, man, it's great that you're going to all these meetings and this, that, and you got a problem, and you know, you're praying, but we need to work on these steps. I was like, yeah, I know. They're up here. 12 of them. I see them. There's 12 of those, 12 of those. I mean, that's 24. That's how many hours are in a day. You know, I could go on and on. some things changed, and his life went one direction. He's still around. And Big Doug became an integral part of my life. Mm-hmm. And he was more like my kind of people, the biker type, big burly, you know. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and you know, if I change sponsors, it's not because I don't, you know, don't take it personal. It's because I think something's different on the other side of the fence. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just trying to play another guy, is all it was. Mm-hmm. And Big Doug's the same way. He's like, yeah, man, we need to work these steps. I'm like, yeah, I know, you know. And I was working 1, 2, 3, and 12. I knew I had a problem. I knew I couldn't do nothing about it without God's help.
Didn't want to do that fourth and
fifth, right?
Huh?
Oh no, eight and nine.
Yeah.
I don't know what I can say on the radio, but
anything you want, you can't swear. But
well, there's a B word that I'd like to use. That I heard a guy say one time.
You need to make an amend to.
No. He was reading the eighth step, and he goes, "What was it? The ninth step? We made direct amends to such, or made a list of people we
that's eight,
harmed
the list,
and became willing to make amends to them all." And went, son of a.
Oh, gotcha.
Right at the end of it. And I was like, dude, what? Made amends to all of them? Oh, no way. So Big Doug tricked me. He said, man, we're going to do a Joe and Charlie study. And he goes, I know you're off work on Wednesday, so we're going to do it at my house. Wednesday's at 6:30. You can be there.
Perfect.
Damn. I hate when they're right. Yeah. And you know, if you do a Joe and Charlie study, that you end up going through the big book and working the steps.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
So that happened to you?
Yeah. Yeah, he tricked me.
And was that your turning point for sobriety?
No, actually, wait, I need to back up. That was the second trip to sobriety. The first trip to sobriety, I didn't work any steps.
Just dry.
Dry.
Going to meetings. Seeing old Jim
Fellowship.
Christian. Yeah.
Jim Christian, Fritz Bainey.
Everybody
you know,
loved
Sonny.
Trey. I remember that. You were just the
dances.
Yeah.
You know, Denny's until 2 in the morning, whatever.
Yep, he was everybody's friend, and everybody loved Trey, and we were all glad to see Trey coming back in the room as a young person.
Oh, after the year, I started, I was like 14 months, I started somebody was smoking some weed, and I was like, man, I always love the smell of that. And my theory is this. Weed never made me want to fight anybody. It made me want to play video games and call the pizza guy.
Just leave people alone.
Leave people alone. So I started smoking a little weed.
You start justifying smoking some pot, huh?
I was smoking some pot about 14 months. That lasted about 2 weeks. And I was in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, you know, and like I said, a big biker party.
What do you think happened? Here you were a year in the middle of the fellowship and went out and smoked weed. Looking back now, what?
I was in the fellowship. I wasn't working a program.
Oh.
There's a world of difference.
Yep.
A ton of difference.
Yes.
And it took me, you know, 6 months of my life.
And you're right. Signing those sheets doesn't say you're working a program. It just says you're going to the...
That's a whole nother issue with me. That's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
I call your buddy Judge about once a year and gripe at him.
Which one, Meyer or Trockman?
Trockman.
Do you?
Oh, I love him. Yeah.
Yeah, great judges.
Yeah, he
great.
Is. He's a good dude. Mm-hmm. And,
it's that accountability. But you're right. It doesn't mean they're working a program. So you were accountable. You went, but you hadn't really surrendered.
I hadn't. I wasn't changing anything other than not drinking and going to meetings.
And hanging out with sober people.
You know.
Takes action. You know,
yeah.
Passively sitting in the rooms. You get good. It helps change your thinking, but changing your action is different.
Right. Right.
You got to have people hear you, girl. Get up that microphone. Don't be scared.
So soft-spoken.
I know, and she's like a mouse over there. Who's that squeaking in the corner?
Well, don't go away, Radio Rehab. We will be back talking more with Trey. If you have any questions and want to know anything about recovery or about Trey and just how he does it, his experience, strength, and hope, don't hesitate to call 424-1400. Trey is an open book, and he wouldn't mind answering any questions or concerns. So don't hesitate to call back. We are going to take just a few minute break and be back.